Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 8th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, regulating direct-to-consumer personal genome tests, producing single crystal structures at the nanoscale, and the scientific challenges in returning remains to native peoples. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how the moon influences rainfall, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The Human Genome Project took over a decade to complete and cost U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars. While there are many lessons still to be learned from analyzing that data, continued innovation in sequencing technology means that you can, almost anywhere in the world via the internet, spend a few hundred dollars and learn about your own genetic susceptibility to, say, diabetes, Alzheimer's, or cancer. However, many governmental regulatory agencies warn consumers to interpret such at-home genetic test results with a healthy dose of skepticism, suggesting that the tests may not be clinically valid.
Most genetic screening tests are not currently regulated in the United States.
Amy McGuire is a medical ethicist and researches health policy at Baylor College of Medicine. She is lead author of a policy forum in this week's Science about regulating such tests.
And part of it is because the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has exercised their enforcement discretion by not regulating what are called lab-developed tests. And these are tests that are developed in-house and are sold by the individual who developed the test. And so most genetic tests are considered lab-developed tests, and so they haven't been regulated by the Food and Drug Administration.
But that may change. The difficulty is in figuring out how to do it and where to set the limits on regulation. Looking to other countries, the United Kingdom has responded similarly to the United States, producing policy reports and educating the public. Germany simply banned public access to these private tests. Beyond the concern of whether the tests are valid or not, McGuire says there's the additional concern that people will make important healthcare decisions based on the test results without consulting a doctor.
One of the key issues here is that any genetic testing really needs to be done in the context of a holistic picture of the patient. So genetics is just one piece of the puzzle. And in interpreting a genetic test result, you also need to have other pieces of the puzzle to fit it into. So family history is incredibly important. Any existing symptoms that the patient may have would be particularly important in understanding how significant the risk is for the individual and what the likelihood of that person developing the particular disease that the genetic test is intended to disclose risk information about.
And this is where we're failing at present. We also need to ensure that their privacy is protected.
Jim Evans is a practicing medical geneticist at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and is not an author of the policy forum.
When somebody says to me, why can't I have the information that is contained in my own genome on my own terms, that's a legitimate question. So the public doesn't necessarily want us to regulate this out of existence, but they deserve proper regulation that protects their interests.
And proper regulation, McGuire argues, is what's called a risk-stratified approach.
So some of the things that these companies are testing for are perfectly harmless, and they should fall under the buyer beware model, in my opinion. So things like information about your ancestry. It's not very health-related. It's information that a lot of people are interested in, and there's no reason that the Food and Drug Administration or anybody else should get involved in regulating that type of information.
Nor is regulation needed for genetic tests that are, as McGuire puts it, recreational.
So some of these companies give you information about what's your earwax type, or do you have the gene that makes you more susceptible to be sensitive to bitter taste, or things like that. Those sorts of things are not going to significantly impact healthcare.
But even among the tests in which knowledge of genetic information is going to significantly impact healthcare, McGuire argues, stratification is needed.
So there might be genes that they're looking for that are associated with common and complex disorders, that if you have this particular genetic variant, it very slightly increases your risk of getting heart disease or diabetes. There's probably not a whole lot that they can do in response to that information other than eat better, go on a diet. And then there's the type of information that a lot of these companies are testing for, like the BRCA genes that tell you whether you have a significantly increased risk of developing breast cancer. And that's medical information that warrants some additional follow-up and consideration in terms of what kind of surveillance you're going to do and whether treatment is necessary or not, depending on your other risk factors like family history. So in those circumstances where you have very high-risk tests that may lead to important health decisions, you probably want to regulate them more stringently than you would for information about your earwax type.
That suggests a need for some kind of threshold, McGuire adds, for what tests are regulated and what tests are not. Because regulating on a case-by-case basis, or rather gene variant by gene variant basis, would be too burdensome for any regulatory agency.
And we need data, right?
Again, Jim Evans of the University of North Carolina School of Medicine.
We need to begin to define what are the benefits, what are the harms. My personal feeling is that the alleged benefits of most of this testing have been wildly exaggerated by companies that are offering it. And I think that that is not necessarily due to overt attempts at deception, but could simply be just extraordinary naivete on the part of scientists who don't understand the messiness of clinical medicine and medical practice.
And so both Evans and McGuire say the first step in properly regulating direct-to-consumer personal genomic tests, at least in the United States, is for the government agencies that already have jurisdiction just to enforce existing guidelines, starting with eliminating overhyped advertising. You can read McGuire and colleagues' policy forum, Regulating Direct-to-Consumer Personal Genome Testing, in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, genetic engineering. To combat pests such as the European corn borer moth, farmers in 1996 in the United States began growing genetically engineered corn called BT corn. This variety produces proteins in its leaves that are toxic to the pests that feed on the plants. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Bill Hutchinson and colleagues estimate that this genetically engineered corn has saved corn farmers a collective $6.9 billion U.S. dollars over the last 14 years. What's more, it's the growers of non-BT corn who have reaped the most financial reward. That, the researchers say, is because these farmers have benefited from what is called the halo effect, in which the BT toxins from transgenic corn deliver a decline in pest population in neighboring non-BT corn fields as well. And that saves the non-BT corn farmers from the pests and from the premium prices for genetically engineered corn seed. The researchers hope that this economic analysis will boost compliance with what's called the refuge strategy, which requires farmers to plant non-BT corn alongside BT corn to minimize the risk of the European corn borer or any other pest developing resistance to the BT toxin. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Mastering manufacturing processes at the nanoscale has long been a goal in the semiconductor and electronics industry. And that's because there are potentially enormous gains to be had in the efficiency of, say, converting solar energy to electricity or storing energy. But only if researchers can build on the scale, the nanoscale, where photons and electrons interact with these manufactured materials. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Ulrich Wiesner and colleagues at Cornell University describe their proof-of-principle experiment that demonstrates they can control the placement of what are called epitaxial single-crystal nanostructures using simple methods that are well-known to the electronics industry. I spoke with Wiesner from Germany, where he was attending a conference.
My community finally, through this paper, has been able to achieve the ultimate order on the nanoscale for inorganic materials using organic materials as structure-directing agents. In this way, we're mimicking what nature has been doing for millions of years. Take your bones and take your teeth, where you have crystalline materials that are structure-directed by organic materials, but the materials are inorganic. And so what we have done now, and that's very exciting for us, is that now, in addition to just having crystalline materials which could be, for example, crystallites that have all kinds of orientation in three-dimensional space. Now, through a special technique, we were able to generate crystalline materials that are single crystals, meaning the ultimate order of the atoms and the crystallites are all aligned in one direction relative to a substrate.
And what are these single crystalline materials made of?
In our case, we have in the paper mainly worked on one material, and that is silicon, which is a very well-known semiconductor. But we also have shown that this should be a more general approach. And in the paper, in addition to silicon, we show that nickel silicide as a material works as well. And the interesting finding there is, in the same way as with silicon, with nickel silicide, we also get single crystals, and they also have this perfect orientational order, generating a single crystal that has, if you like, an orientational relation to its substrate.
So is it the scale, then, that's the characteristic of what hadn't been done before?
Yes, because single crystals and single crystal epitaxy, which describes the ability to get a single crystal with a very well-defined orientation relative to a substrate, all these things are very well known. But what I think is new in this paper is the fact that we have now been able to make such materials which are structured in addition on the nanoscale. So the resulting, for example, silicon material is a single crystal. It has this epitaxial relation, this orientation relation to the substrate, and it is nanostructured. In our case, it's nanoporous. So it has structural dimensions of only order 10, 20 nanometers or so.
And are there particular applications imagined for growing these single crystal nanostructured inorganic materials on a single crystal underlying substrate? Or is this more of a check of a theoretical result, more along the lines of pure research?
No, actually, that's a very good question. And in fact, we hope that this will generate a lot of interest, in particular in the community that currently is focusing on generating more efficient energy conversion and storage devices. It is believed that nanostructures ultimately may be a key to get the maximum efficiency, for example, out of solar cells or out of batteries, as an example. And so there are many examples in the literature where people have worked on nanostructures for these applications. But these nanostructures, in almost all cases that I'm aware of, are made out of polycrystalline materials, meaning the materials are crystalline, but they have little crystallites or consist of little crystallites that have all kinds of random orientations relative to one another. And the transport is never maximized in these systems. So what you could envision easily is now that the porous nanostructure that we have generated as a single crystal, for example, could be backfilled with a Hall conductor and could be sensitized with a dye, and then we could generate a Gretzel cell. And at least in principle, because of the single crystal nature of these materials, there should be no trapsides, at least at interfaces between crystalline domains or scattering sites, and therefore these materials should not be mobility limited or transport limited, and that is hoped to make an impact in these areas.
Have you all, at this point, tested these materials for their properties?
No. And so far, it is the first proof of principle that these materials can be structured on the nanoscale and at the same time be a single crystal and at the same time have a well-defined relation to the underlying substrate. So that itself is a proof of principle experiment which we have been able to demonstrate. But now, if you like, researchers and maybe even my own group, we now have to go ahead and try to apply these kind of findings to the generation of more efficient solar cells or batteries.
What challenges remain, then, in making these materials ready to leave the lab?
That's a very good and extremely relevant question. In the paper, we show that one of the critical issues in order to be able to generate the single crystal with the relation to the substrate is that on silicon, which we used as a substrate, the native oxide, which usually is, you know, 1 or 2 nanometers thick on the surface of silicon if it's not specifically treated, that oxide layer needs to be etched away. And the way we etch it away is we have to etch it through the pores, because first we put the oxide sponge on top of the substrate, and then we have to etch it such that the oxide doesn't get etched away, but the native oxide layer gets etched away. And that's essentially a tricky business because, as you may imagine, you know, especially if the films get thicker, it's not easy to time this right. And we have done this with fluoric acid, which eats oxides away easily, but it was quite tricky. It took us a long time to get the conditions right. So I think in, you know, the highly developed fabrication labs of the microelectronics industry, they can use HF vapor, for example. And I believe then it would be much easier to essentially etch this oxide away.
The acid as a vapor form.
Yes, exactly. So instead of liquid HF, which we have used, which needs to wet these pores and has to be sucked in all the way to the substrate surface, the vapor is much easier to penetrate these holes, and then you can leave the etch time presumably shorter, and it should be a cleaner process. That is the challenge, and that's an engineering challenge that really has to be solved in order to make this process easily doable, you know, for large-scale applications, if you like.
But it sounds like with this, as you described, just being an engineering problem, there may not be too many steps for an industry-capable lab that has this vapor form of this acid to dissolve that oxide layer.
I think that's probably true, but I haven't really talked to the industry about it yet. So I have to admit that I don't know the details of, you know, how difficult that would be. That is something that we certainly need to explore now in the near future in order to better understand what the limitations are.
Ulrich Wiesner, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Ulrich Wiesner of Cornell University is senior author of a paper on the self-assembly of single crystal nanostructures. Also in this week's Science, the nitrogen cycle evolves. The modern nitrogen cycle began around 2.7 billion years ago when a linked suite of microbial processes evolved. This nitrogen cycle has a number of natural feedbacks and controls to stay in balance, but over the past 100 years, our activity has thrown it out of balance, particularly with the development of nitrogen-based agricultural practices to satisfy the growing demand for food. In a paper in this week's Science, Donald Canfield and colleagues review the modern nitrogen cycle, how our activity has thrown it out of balance, and what that has done to our planet. The researchers suggest over time, microorganisms will restore balance to the nitrogen cycle, but the damage we have done will persist for decades, possibly centuries, unless we intervene and initiate careful management strategies. Read the paper, The Evolution and Future of Earth's Nitrogen Cycle, in this week's Science.
So this is a package about a law that was passed 20 years ago to allow Native Americans to reclaim remains and objects that were buried in graves from museums and other institutions.
Science's Elizabeth Culotta edits a package of stories in this week's issue on the scientific challenges in returning remains and objects to Native peoples, and a new controversy over returning even ancient bones that cannot be linked to an existing people.
So 20 years ago, they passed this law. And at the time, scientists fought the law because it meant that many of these objects were going to be taken out of scientific study. And so for 20 years, scientists and Native Americans have been sort of arguing and debating, but really also working together to get these items back to tribes. And so this package is about that, and the reason to do it now is because it is the 20th anniversary, and also because they promulgated some new rules in May, which actually broadened tribes' claim. And many scientists are worried that these new rules are going to start tensions erupting all over again, because the new rules now say that tribes have access to things that they didn't used to, and people are really worried about a loss to science.
Before we get to that, is this issue unique to the United States, that Native peoples are seeking the return of ancient skeletons?
Not at all. Countries around the world are dealing with this question. And we have one story in the package that looks at attitudes around the world to what you do with ancient remains, right? And in some countries, there is no problem. For example, in Europe, people are excited about having scientists study the remains of ancient people, like Ossie the Iceman, who was a 5,000-year-old mummy found in the Alps. Everyone was excited about the prospect of scientifically studying him. However, in other countries, say Australia, the Australian Aborigines are concerned because, in part, it was the white colonialists who came over, and they took some Australian Aboriginal remains and took them to museums in England, for example, without permission. And the Aborigines are not happy about this, and they've been asking for those back. In the United States, all this started because of some really terrible practices, actually, that went on in the 19th and early 20th centuries when military personnel and some archaeologists dug up some Native American remains and put them in museums, so that the collection practices back at that time were really extremely disrespectful. And because many Native Americans have great reverence for their ancestors and for the dead, this was especially offensive to them. And so that's why, for Native Americans, this became an important issue. It was taking control of their ancestors in their minds. So around the world, it really varies.
In the United States, then, what's been the effect of this law on archaeologists and anthropologists and other scientists over the 20 years in which this has been a law?
So that's what our stories are about, and there have really been a couple different kinds of effects. For one thing, it does mean that there is some loss of data to science, because when tribes get these objects and remains back, they rebury them, and that means that scientists can no longer study them. However, many scientists also say that there has been a beneficial effect. And part of this is interesting because it has forced scientists and Native Americans to work together, because they have to work together to figure out to which tribe, for example, the objects go back to. They have to work together to do this. And this has been really good, and it has forged some relationships between these two communities. It has also allowed, for example, scientists perhaps to learn more about some oral traditions and ethnographic information from Native Americans that they've been able to use in their scholarship. So it's had sort of a mixed effect. And many scientists will say, actually, that even though there's been a loss of data to science, they do feel that the human rights aspects are important, and they understand this. However, the new regulations are something else again, because the new regulations say that if there are bones that can't be tied to a particular tribe, tribes that live in the region can claim them anyway. In other words, if there's nothing cultural to tie them to a particular group of people, the tribe that lives in that region can still claim these. And this concerns scientists because perhaps the most valuable specimens to science are typically the oldest ones. Those are, say, these 8,000 to 12,000-year-old skeletons that scientists call Paleo-Indians. And they're important because they get to this big unanswered question of who settled the Americas. It's kind of amazing to me that we still don't actually know the details of how and when that happened. And that field has actually moved slowly. There's not been that much progress in that field recently.
And previously, any claim on these unaffiliated human remains, these really ancient skeletons, were exempt?
That's right. Previously, the unaffiliated remains, which would include the ancient ones usually, were exempt, exactly. And in fact, there was a lawsuit over one of them, Kennewick Man, and which scientists won because it was considered exempt. And so those remains could stay in the museums.
So are Native American groups acting now with this new extension of this law to recover these ancient skeletons, even though they cannot be linked to people living today?
No one is sure exactly if this new law, new rules, will spark a wave of requests from Native Americans to get these oldest skeletons back. It's not yet clear. The rules came out in May, and no one's exactly sure what will happen. But scientists are worried that they may.
Beyond the Kennewick case that you mentioned earlier, are there other particular cases where scientists have fought to hold on to these human remains for study?
There's a case going on right now that's current, and this has to do with the University of California, San Diego. They found some 10,000-year-old skeletons actually on the university land right beneath the provost's house, and they found these bones, I believe, in the 1970s. But the local Indian tribe feels that these bones must be their ancestors, and they want them back. Scientists, however, feel that because these bones are so old, that they are not linked to the current tribe. And so those bones are in dispute right now, and right now remain locked away in a neutral facility.
So are there any consensus builders to sort of forge the differences into a common solution for both scientists and for the Native American peoples?
I think that's what many scientists would like to try to do. And there are some examples. For example, there's a place in Alaska called On Your Knees Cave where scientists discovered some about 10,000-year-old skeletons, one skeleton actually, of a man. And they immediately notified the local Tlingit tribe. And the tribe and scientists worked together, and the tribe allowed the scientists to study these bones for 10 years. And then the tribe said that they would like the bones back after 10 years. So after 10 years, they gave the bones back to the tribe, and the tribe reburied them, and they had a celebration together that included both scientists and Native Americans. And in that case, they got some useful data. They were able to link DNA from that skeleton to tribes that now live in Central California. So it was a success story.
I imagine those scientists would still like to continue having access to those bones as DNA methods get better and better.
That's exactly right, because methods always improve. So from a scientific standpoint, what you'd really like is to be able to hang on to these bones, you know, for as long as possible. So they realized that if you're going to work with Native Americans on this, you're going to have to compromise a little. But if you look in the far future, many people say that what we really need is to have Native American archaeologists leading the study of their own past. And that means you've got to have Native Americans trained in archaeology. And so in the package, we looked at that, actually, and talked to some of the Native American archaeologists who at the moment are kind of, you know, working in two worlds and finding that sometimes their traditions clash with scientific inquiry, but they are also making a difference.
Elizabeth Culotta, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Elizabeth Culotta edits a package of stories in this week's issue on the scientific challenges in returning remains and objects to Native peoples and a new controversy over returning even ancient bones that cannot be linked to an existing people. As part of the package of stories, Science's John Travis writes on the search to identify the true remains and prove the lineage of one of the most famous Native American chiefs, Sitting Bull. Here's John Travis with a short story from his reporter's notebook.
When I was in Copenhagen at a meeting devoted to biomolecular archaeology, I first learned about the effort to retrieve and identify Sitting Bull's DNA. It was a slide flashed up by a postdoc of Eska Willerslev, who's a noted ancient DNA researcher, and I tracked him down during a break and asked him about the project. He hadn't talked about it before. He knows it's a sensitive topic. Native Americans have had past issues with how their ancestors have been studied, and in particular, what DNA can tell them about their past. But he grew up loving Sitting Bull, and when he heard that Ernie LaPointe, the great-grandson of Sitting Bull, was trying to identify where his ancestor was buried, Eska called him up and said that he might be able to help. And so now he and Ernie are analyzing a piece of DNA from Sitting Bull's hair that was in the Smithsonian collections for years without anyone knowing it. And ultimately, if they can get DNA from that hair, and it's not sure that they can get enough DNA from it, they hope to prove whether Sitting Bull is indeed in a grave in South Dakota. And if so, Ernie would like to remove his great-grandfather and bury him in another grave, one known only to his family.
Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how the moon influences rainfall. How much of an effect are we talking about here, Dave?
Well, Rob, this is actually a very small effect. The researchers say it's only about 1% to 2% of the variation in rainfall might be explained by the moon, but it's still impressive that the moon, even though as large of a body as it is, could actually have an effect on weather here on Earth. You know, this has been part of folklore for a long time. Farmers used to believe that certain phases of the moon were good for crops or for rainfall. There's even American traditions that have to do with the moon and weather. And researchers actually looked into this. In the 1960s, there was a few studies done about whether the moon really does play a role in rainfall patterns, but nothing really conclusive came out of that.
And so in this study?
Well, in this study, they have a lot more data. Now they have data going back 100 years. They have something called the U.S. Historical Climatology Network, which actually has data on rainfall patterns going back to 1895 from over 1,200 sites around the U.S. So the researchers said, you know, we've got a lot more data now. Let's see if we can draw some more firm conclusions about what role, if any, the moon plays in rainfall.
And when does this 1% to 2% change occur?
Well, here's what the researchers did. They looked at 11,000 U.S. Geological Survey research stations on inland streams throughout the U.S. And again, they had data on these streams going back to the 1900s. And what they saw was they looked at various phases of the moon. And what they saw was a slight increase in runoff from these streams during the quarter moon, which is about halfway between the full and the new moon.
and that links to rainfall directly?
Well, it does. That's a good question, because the moon can influence the tides and things like that. So it's possible the moon would be having an effect on the streams that has nothing to do with rainfall. So just to be sure, what the researchers did was they went to this U.S. Historical Climatology Network, and they looked at rainfall patterns throughout history. And what they saw was indeed that during a few days before the quarter moon, they saw this increase in downpour. Again, it's a very small change in rainfall patterns, just about 1 to 2% outside what you would expect as a normal variation. But they say it's a very solid change that seems to be directly linked to the phases of the moon.
So are they now looking to investigate hypotheses as to what it is exactly that the moon's doing?
Right. Well, that's the next thing. It's like, if the moon is actually doing this, how is it doing it? And there's actually no new hypotheses. There were some hypotheses proposed in the 1960s when researchers first started looking at this, some pretty wild hypotheses. One is that the moon somehow affects the magnetosphere, which is this magnetic field that protects the Earth from solar radiation. Other scientists have said that somehow the moon might create a pressure bulge that would affect storm systems in our atmosphere. And others have said that maybe there's something about the lunar dust. Maybe it's in certain phases of the moon, there's more dust reaching the Earth. And what scientists do know is that dust helps seed raindrops. So if you get dust into clouds, that might increase rainfall. But these are all very speculative at this point. All the researchers know for sure, or what they say they know for sure, is that the moon seems to influence rainfall patterns. But just how is going to need a little bit more work.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the moon potentially seeding clouds with rainfall to volcanoes seeding the oceans with iron. This next story is about how volcanoes can dramatically increase the growth of phytoplankton in Earth's seas.
Where's this data coming from?
Well, Rob, this is a bit of a serendipitous study. Researchers were actually out on a research cruise near the Aleutian Islands in the northeastern Pacific Ocean. And they were taking measurements, and this is actually a very well-studied patch of ocean in this area. And so researchers really know, you know, how much phytoplankton. And phytoplankton are these microscopic plants that live in the water. They photosynthesize. That means they get their sustenance from light, but they also need other elements like nitrate and phosphate and iron to grow. So the researchers have data on these organisms. But what they noticed during this research cruise was there was this huge spike in phytoplankton numbers over a very short period of time. And this was around August of 2008. And the researchers said, what could cause such a big spike, sudden spike in phytoplankton? So what the researchers did was they took a lot of measurements. They looked at variations in sunlight, changes in wind patterns, even ocean currents, trying to explain what was happening. And what they eventually found at the end of the day was they saw this 5 to 10-fold spike in dissolved iron in the water. And because the phytoplankton need iron to proliferate, they figured that this was explaining this population explosion that they were seeing.
So the iron came from a volcano?
Exactly. There was a volcanic eruption on the Aleutian Islands around that time. And this volcano didn't really hurt anybody. It's a pretty remote part of the world. But what it did do is it spewed this huge cloud of volcanic ash into the air, and this ash contains iron. And not only did it spew all this iron-rich ash into the air, but there was also a windstorm around the same time that blew this ash far and wide into the ocean. So that's how the researchers figure that all this iron got into the ocean, which the phytoplankton gorged on, and their numbers just exploded.
Now, I understand that iron fertilization has been one of these geoengineering projects to take carbon dioxide out of the air. This is just more evidence that it's happening naturally.
Right. And it's actually also evidence that that particular geoengineering scheme might not work. As you mentioned, Rob, you know, researchers have thought that if they throw a lot of iron into the ocean, they can really increase these phytoplankton blooms. And the reason they want to do that is because phytoplankton sucks CO2 out of the atmosphere. And CO2 is one of those really big greenhouse gases. So the idea would be you increase these plumes and you can help slow global warming. The problem with the researchers saw in this case was, yes, iron does really increase the number of phytoplankton. We saw this in this natural experiment with this volcano, but they didn't detect a big effect on the amount of CO2 that was being removed from the atmosphere. So they say that, at least according to this natural experiment, that particular geoengineering scheme may not be that effective.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from figuring out where all the phytoplankton in the ocean came from to figuring out where thoroughbred horses came from, this last story is about tracing the lineage of these highly regarded horses that are used in everything from racing to fox hunting.
So scientists working to confirm the lineages that horse traders already know about.
Well, it's a good point, Rob. I mean, in fact, breeders already know a lot about where these horses came from. They are believed to have originated from so-called Arabian horses, horses in the Middle East, around the late 1600s and early 1700s. And the idea was that breeders would take the male Arabian horses, breed them with females, and this is how the lineage has sort of been propagated over time. And these very early horses were very famous. There's paintings of them. They are recorded in record books. So we know a lot about who the dads were for these thoroughbred horses, but we don't know anything about who the moms were because breeders were only selecting the Arabian males and they kept a record of the males, but they didn't pay very much attention to the females. Part of the society at that time was that females just weren't viewed as very important. And even for passing down traits, it was thought that the mother didn't contribute very much. It was all based on the father. So it didn't matter who you mated the mother with. As long as the father was a big, strong horse, you were ostensibly going to get big, strong, sleek offspring.
So what did researchers do to trace back the lineage of the mothers?
Well, Rob, they focused on something called mitochondrial DNA, and this is a different kind of DNA than the DNA we usually talk about, which is the DNA in our nucleus. But our cell also has a lot of compartments called mitochondria, which are the powerhouses for the cell that provide the energy, and they have their own DNA. And what's different about this DNA is it's only passed down from the mother. So by looking at this DNA, you can just focus on the maternal lineage. There's no contamination, as it were, from the father. And also there are markers in this mitochondrial DNA that can also give you clues to location, to where in the world this DNA came from.
So of the famous horses today, researchers are looking at the maternal lines and they're finding that they came from where?
Well, they're finding that they came from the UK, specifically from the British Isles. And that's an important discovery because there had been some back and forth about where these moms came from. Some people had suggested that the moms themselves were Arabian horses. And others had suggested, no, you know, when these horses were brought to the UK, they were mated with local mares there. And so the moms were probably British. And indeed, that seems to be the case. That's what the mitochondrial DNA suggests, is that the mothers were from a different geographical location than the fathers were from.
And why are researchers so interested in this?
Well, Rob, one of the things was just to really settle this debate about where the moms came from. But sort of an ancillary finding here is this whole idea that we're actually learning a lot about human culture by studying these horses. Just the fact that the records being kept were not very well kept for the females and people historically didn't really care where the mothers came from, it just shows how much human social conventions have changed since the 1700s.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got stories about robots that look like stingrays. And also, we're going to be running a special Q&A with readers about the North American repatriation story that you talked about earlier in the podcast, returning Native American remains to their origins. Readers can check out the package online, but they can also ask questions of our staff. And the staff writers that worked on the story will respond to readers. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the Gulf oil spill, a new task force that's been convened to help restore the Gulf and the waters in that region. And also a dark story in U.S. history about a U.S.-funded study that infected Guatemalan patients with syphilis about a half century ago. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the October 8th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.